Welcome. Welcome to the Missouri Valley Special Collections for another Missouri Valley Sunday. My name is Eli Paul, and I'm the head of the Missouri Valley Special Collections, and I thank you for coming out on this mildly rainy Sunday afternoon. Thank you. I think you're in for a treat today because we've combined what I think are two exciting topics, the Civil War and archaeology, all in one package, and of course focusing on our home region here in the Missouri Valley area. As many of you know, the Kansas City Public Library has taken the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. We can't pronounce it, but we can do it. We've taken it to heart with an abundance of programming over the past year and a half. In fact, our next one will be September 12th when Jim Denny will talk about the 1862 Battle of Island Mound. As you can tell, we do an anniversary of the event 150 years later, so you can see we have years of programming to go. And you can keep track of this on our monthly calendars. The end of the August calendar is up, but the September calendars are floating around, so be sure and pick one of those up to see what's coming. Also in September, if you looked at the brochure that was on your seat, we have not one, but two Missouri Valley Sunday events. The first one on September 9th is relating to Kansas City in the 1940 U.S. Census. Our speaker will be Lori Cox Paul of the National Archives. She's no relation, only my wife, but she comes cheap and does a good job. So September 9th, that'll be a really good one. She's really focusing on the U.S. Census in Kansas City. Has a lot of good, if you want to see where Tom Pendergast was, at least his house was, and his family. He was in the pen, of course, but you can see where the rest of the Pendergasts were in 1940. And then the week after that, September 16th, Bob Priddy will be talking about the art of the Missouri Capitol. It's a book he wrote last year, really a beautiful book on the art and architecture in the Missouri State Capitol. Unfortunately, I don't think it included anything about the Rush Limbaugh statue, so you'll have to ask him a tough question there, I think. Finally, along with all these events, we, of course, on Missouri Valley Sundays, we have the Missouri Valley Room, that is open for research. John Horner, one of our associates of the library, is in there. If after this program you want to go in and drop by and look around, please do so. We welcome you there. And we also welcome people who are interested in helping our work with the Missouri Valley Special Collections. There's also brochures relating to becoming a Missouri Valley Room MVR Club member, in which we are looking for people to help us add materials to our historical collection. So a lot going on in the library, and we're very happy that you chose to come out today for this event. And now for today's talk. The Civil War in the Trans-Mississippi West is a big, sprawling historical subject and has received a lot of attention, no more so than now the sesquicentennial. You have heard and read a lot about its battles, leaders, and politics, and correspondingly little, I bet, about the archaeology of the people, places, and things involved in the war. Today, that will be addressed in detail by Doug Scott, particularly for the 1861 battles of Boonville and Wilson's Creek and the 1864 Centralia Massacre, and he is a person eminently qualified to do so. Doug Scott is currently affiliated with the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, but I knew him, and you may know of him, from his long career with the National Park Service. He has worked throughout the Great Plains and Rocky Mountain West on a variety of archaeological projects and specializes in, some may say, has defined 19th century military sites archaeology and forensic archaeology. Battlefield material culture and firearms identification and explaining what they all mean have become his life's work and passion. And Doug has explored scientifically more than 50 battlefield sites across the country, even the world. Most famously, The Little Bighorn, and Custer's Last Stand. His books include Archaeological Perspectives on the Battle of the Little Bighorn, They Died with Custer, Soldier's Bones from the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and Finding Sand Creek, History, Archaeology, and the 1864 Massacre Site. His contribution to the field of archaeology has been recognized by many awards, as well as having served as the president of the Society for Historical Archaeology. We in the Missouri Valley region are indeed fortunate that he has turned his attention to this part of the world in his recent investigations. Now, for full disclosure, Doug is also a longtime friend and colleague, and I'm being very selfish today because I want to hear about his latest discoveries myself. So it is with great pleasure that I welcome him to the Kansas City Public Library, and please welcome Doug Scott.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. And by the way, I'm a Missouri native. I'm from Harrison County. So I'm back home. And what I am going to do today is give you a little tour of battlefield archaeology, a little bit worldwide to put a context on what we have been working with in here in Missouri in the last several years since I retired from the National Park Service. And I'm not going to concentrate on the story of specific battles as battles and what happened. I'll give you a little bit of that. But mostly what I'm going to do is explain to you how the archaeological record can add to what we already know about a very rich historic past, especially with the American Civil War in the Trans-Mississippi West. Just a quick acknowledgement to a number of people who have helped over the years in the work we've done, Jack Chance, Friends of Centralia, Wilson Creek Battlefield, Midwest Archaeological Center, who used to be my employee, and now the government pays me not to come to work, which I like a lot. Steve Dasovich at Lindenwood University, Tom Thiessen from Lincoln, Nebraska is an old friend, and with hundreds of really very fine volunteers from around the Missouri and the surrounding area. Now, battlefield archaeology, conflict archaeology as it's really more known as today, is a very dynamic and growing field. Now, I'm just going to give you a couple of minutes of some worldwide examples to show you this. What we're doing is not in isolation anymore. It's not something that is unique anymore. A lot of the work we did, it started with the work that Richard Fox and I and Melissa Connor did at Little Bighorn Battlefield. And that's now almost 30 years ago. I was 12. Some of the other places in the world where battlefields and conflicts have been studied, a little place called Kalkrisa in Germany. And this is, to the best of my knowledge, is the oldest site that's ever been found by using metal detectors as a battlefield. And it's 9 AD. This is where Varus's legions were destroyed by Artemis, or Hermann the German. This is some of the battlefield relics they found. Some ways are a little nicer than what we find. But I like bullets, so there. Those are Roman shield and weapon parts and armor parts. And that this is what kind of set things off, as a centurion's face mask from a helmet. And with that, they were able to reconstruct the events that occurred in 9 AD when Varus's three legions were destroyed and under the Emperor Augustus. It turned out to be a little more complex than Tacitus and some of the other Roman historians like to acknowledge. So these kind of things are being done around the world. There are places being done in the American Southwest looking at Coronado's Spanish Entrada. This is the Pueblo of Hawiku. It's an archaeological site, ancestral Pueblo. But it was attacked by Coronado, and they have actually found crossbow bolts, horseshoe nails, arquebus or musket balls, and even pieces of copper armor. So again, it's happening. And more complex sites of the 20th century. These are World War I battlefield site. in Belgium, in this particular case, that's actually being done by an archaeological, or was, by the Belgian Antiquity Service, and using modern geographic information systems, which I'll allude to a little later on in some of the work we've done to help us analyze data. These are old trench lines with historic photographs of the trenches and bomb craters, and the red lines indicate stuff that's actually still there. And this is the kind of thing they find, including lots of human remains of other guys that were not recovered, the missing in action, British, German, French, Belgian, you name it. And then there are iconic things like this. That's the Hunley, the first submarine to sink a warship, the Housatonic, in Charleston Harbor, originally found by Clive Cussler, the author and novelist, and is now being preserved, and it will take, it's already been about 10 years that they've had it up, but it'll take another decade or so before it's fully ready to exhibit, although they do it on a daily basis there. And it's remarkable. The crew was still on board when they found them. Now, what I'm going to do is give you a little academic material that Dr. Peter Bleed from the University of Nebraska and I helped develop and built on the stuff over the last 30 years. And I'm not going to bore you too much with this, but we decided that it wasn't appropriate to invent a new model of archaeology when we had good stuff from the military. The military has great ideas about how to fight. They're pretty good at it, especially the American military. And we had very concrete conceptual ideas from the FM3-0, the field manual on operations. And they had some very, very positive stuff. And we, as archaeologists, like to borrow models from somebody else so we don't have to invent everything all by ourselves. We borrowed these models, and they have strategic, operational, and tactical levels of war, which we can adapt to things we find and also allow us to ask questions of the data. And that's what I want to really get into, is why we do stuff that we do and what we can learn from it. And the level of war at which policy plays a role, how things are organized in the field, and what we see as archaeologists are really the results of the tactical operations, the battles, the fights. But it can be related back upward, and I hope I can show you how we do some of that today. This is the visual of the model that allows us to organize our thinking, and I'm not going to bore you with all the details. But we are working down here, but we can build back up, or we can start up here and then ask questions about what will be left in the ground that will tell us something new about a situation. And there are lots of new things that can come out of details of studying the past. We use another military concept to analyze this data, at least on a broad, open terrain scale, and it's called COCOA. You know, it's a good military term. It's also called OCOA, if anybody's been in the military. But it's key terrain, what is important to either take or as an objective or to defend. What can you see from those locations? And we have to adapt this to the time and type of weapons that are being used at a given place. You have concealment and cover, either to protect or defend your personnel. You have obstacles in the way of maneuvering, and you have avenues as approaches, COCOA. So I'll weave some of this in. I won't use those acronyms too heavily. But I am going to talk about particularly Boonville, Wilson's Creek in Centralia, and then Island Mound, which is, what do we do with Butler? Lost it. It's over in here. But I'm just going to briefly mention Island Mound because I knew the talk was coming up with Jim Denny, and we did a little bit of work there too. So I'm going to go in sequence chronologically just to show you some of the things we've been in. We've worked at other sites in Missouri, primarily with Missouri Civil War Heritage Foundation from St. Louis, Greg Wolk, who's trying to help develop a driving trail for the sesquicentennial and get signs in the right places. We also, at Island Mound, we work with Missouri State Parks Group. Well, first battle we'll talk about, June 17th, 1861, and you do realize that's before Bull Run occurred. This is Battle of Boonville, and that sketch that you see up here is, classic armed infantry marching forward with bayonets gleaming and gun positions hammering, in this case, the Missouri State Guard. Of course, they were not Confederates at that particular time under Claiborne Fox Jackson and Sterling Price. They were Missouri State Guardsmen who were of Southern propensity. And against Nathaniel Lyon and Franz Siegel and that gang near Boonville. The Missouri State Guard had left Jefferson City and a camp of recruitment, basically an organization training, and established Camp Vest or Camp Bacon near Boonville, and right on the Missouri. And there's an amphibious assault from steamboats that Lyons, who's pursuing Fox, Claiborne Fox Jackson, and Price, and Missouri State Guard troops, and they know they're at Boonville, they've left Jefferson City. Lyons occupies Jefferson City, and then gets the steamboats and heads up the river in order to try to break the back of the Missouri State Guard and, of course, keep Missouri in the Union. Well, they do, and they meet them up in early June. There are supposed to be about 4,000 guardsmen and roughly 2,000, maybe a few more, Federals. Most of the guardsmen don't even have weapons. They are just in the process of organizing. The thinking is, and I'll come back to that in a minute, that they may have had 500, 400, 600 men that actually were armed. They were a new organization, 30 days. They'd been in process there. So they were very poorly organized, actually poorly led, as a matter of fact. And of course, this is called in the historical record the Boonville Races, because Lyon attacks and the Missouri Guard just flees. Sterling Price was at home, wasn't feeling well, he had diarrhea. Claiborne Fox Jackson directed the army to fight against Marmaduke's, said, no, not here. Let's go away, come back, fight again another day. And the governor said, nope, we're going to fight. They do, and it is a disaster for the State Guard. Now, they do pick up and win a few battles later, which we'll also talk about. So this was an ignominious defeat for the Missouri State Guard and wasn't good for morale either. But we did quite a bit of work on some of the property, and it was all private property, which we were generously allowed access to by the owners. And we found stuff. We find artifacts when we go out, and we do this with metal detectors. We have some archaeologists are professional metal detectors as well, and some amateurs, avocationalists who work with us as volunteers. We found things. So we found cannonball fragments and boot nails and buttons and mini balls and so on, the kind of thing you'd expect to find on a battle site. Wasn't a surprise. Getting the precise location of where this stuff is on the ground is really important. And we didn't try to find it all. Our goal was to identify the location and see what new we could learn from the battle. Well, one of the things that we learned after analyzing the information, and I'll come back to how we analyze this shortly, but this is the process by which we discovered. We knew that the Confederate line, the Missouri State Guard line, I know better, was located near what's called the Adams House, which is right in here. And they aligned on either side of the old Rocheport Road, which is still pretty much the alignment you see right here. In marches, Lyons and with some of the federal Missouri State or Missouri volunteers and some U.S. regulars. And Lyons, of course, had been a captain not many months earlier and had now been promoted to brigadier general, which quite a jump in rank, for his defense of the St. Louis Arsenal. He marches in and sees the alignment of the State Guard. He deploys his men in a similar line and puts a battery of guns, cannon, on the Rocheport Road, and then has his men, Lyons Federals, lie down behind the military crest, behind the hilltop, and the cannons go to work. The Missouri State Guard cannot stand up to the shelling, and they flee, and they cluster up. And it's a matter of command and control in military parlance. They herd together, and then they are the Federals move forward, and they continue to shell that cluster. And about this time, Marmaduke, who has actually mounted up and left because he was so disgusted with the governor's decision to fight, he resigned, basically, by mounting up and riding off. He comes back and takes command and says, "Boys, get out of the hollow. You're just going to be shot up here," which they were being. And we found the evidence, direct evidence of that, with small arms and artillery fire being poured into this one little spot. And he says, "We're going to reform." Now, the story is they form a second line, but it doesn't last. And they fall back, and that becomes the Boonville races, all the way back to Boonville and on beyond for the Missouri State Guard. Well, the interesting part about our archaeological excavation and investigation is that where the Missouri State Guard stood on that second line, and it may have been only about 400 men, is that they did stand and fight. And it may not have been long, but the archaeological evidence suggests there's more to it than this just a few rounds being fired and the State Guard taking off after Marmaduke takes command. What is suggested is in this area is that they stood and took canister shot from the Union artillery, case shot, which is a shrapnel with balls inside of it, and small arms fire. And that we believe the Federals actually charged their position because we found pistol bullets that would only have been fired within a 25-yard, 30-yard range. So, and then the line probably collapsed. So there's good evidence the Missouri State Guard did stand and fight. May not have been very long, but they didn't run because they couldn't take it. They ran. They backed off and retreated, probably rather chaotically, because they were overwhelmed by a superior force of 2,000 to 400. So maybe this isn't just the Boonville races anymore. It's a little bit more complex, and the archaeological record makes this second stand, which is mentioned like one time in the historic record in the Federal side. As you know, that's where they broke and ran. They did, but they stood and fought for a while. And I think that's an important new piece of information. So the view, this is another historic sketch of the First Battle of Boonville from a book called Campfire in Cottonfield by Thomas Knox, who was a reporter who actually was there. I don't know if he drew the sketch or not. He didn't. It was O.C. Richardson. But this is probably more what it looked like. The Federals hunkering down, the guns on the road, and it's not that gleaming bayonet charge that was published in Harper's. Now, Wilson's Creek, I'm going to briefly talk about some of the ways we analyze data by using Wilson's Creek, which, of course, is a National Park Service site, and I actually conducted a 3-year study of Wilson's Creek while I was with the National Park Service for the battlefield archaeology, finding evidence of what was there. Southern troops, as you know, again, Missouri State Guard, they aren't Confederates yet, under Price, and then Texas and Arkansas troops under McCullough, Ben McCullough, who will be killed at Pea Ridge in the next March, come under attack by Nathaniel Lyon again and Franz Sigel. Of course, Lyon will be killed here, and he will be the first general officer to be killed in the Civil War. And he's acting as a captain leading a troop in a charge. So he may have not been appropriately commanding his unit. He couldn't resist getting back into the fray. The CAC comes in from the north and the south on the Missouri State Guard in Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana camps. The cavalry camps are located down here. The infantry camps are located in this area. It's a surprise attack in the morning. It nearly succeeds. The idea was Sigel would attack from the south, and the Lyons from the north. They get them caught, and then as Lyon pushed the southern men down, Sigel would nail them at the south end as they tried to escape, although he was engaged in combat. It didn't work out very well for the Union this particular time. They lost, in case you hadn't heard. But you can, the archaeological record is still extensive within the park. It's been heavily collected. We looked at a lot of the collections themselves, as well as there's still pattern data on the ground. We found things like this, bullets. What do you expect in a battle? These are bullets lost during the fighting. They tell part of the story, and they tell something about the weapons that are used, the types of firearms, which we can go into a great deal about, but I won't bother. It can get kind of boring. But this one is kind of interesting. This bullet was never completed. That was still in a molten state when it was lost. And this confirms some of the accounts of the Southerners actually casting bullets in the camp the night before the battle. They didn't know the battle was going to occur, but they were run low on ammunition, so they were making new ammunition there and rolling their cartridges. Men, some of the accounts talk about, I had a pocket full of bullets, and then some of the guys came by with buckets full of blank ammunition, rolled cartridges with powder in them, and handed them out, so I put those in my other pocket, and then I'd load my weapon and fire. This actually helps say that happened. There's other evidence that supports that as well. Besides the bullets, we found bits and pieces of artillery shell and canister shot. This is a fuse hole. This is a James shell. That one isn't from Wilson's Creek, but in part of the fuse material. And then this type of canister, and canister's like a big shotgun round. It's round iron balls, for the most part, inside a tin can. So it's a big shotgun round that comes out of the cannon at relatively short ranges, 400 or 500 yards. And then you have, there's some of the iron balls that become the canister, about an inch in diameter. So it's not small shot. But then we had these odd ones here. And this is bar shot. We call it expedient canister. It was actually being made in Carthage. The Missouri State Guard ran out of ammo from the fights at Lexington and they didn't use artillery at Boonville, but some elsewhere, Carthage and Lexington. When they captured Carthage, they went to the blacksmith shop and started taking iron bar and iron rod and cutting it up and making it into their own canister and made their own tin cans. The stories abound about that, but there was no good evidence of it, and here it is. And we know which batteries use square stock because they went to a blacksmith shop and got square stock. They talk about it in the record. The other battery, Gabor and Bledsoe, they used different stock. One round, one square. And we could actually found that stuff on the ground. We could figure out, reverse engineer where this stuff came from. Now, just to talk about that stuff, we looked at the metallurgical properties of the cannonballs. And we had an archaeological technician, Alicia Coles, who's actually now working on her PhD at the University of Rhode Island, and figuring out how this stuff worked. She had a background in engineering as well as archaeology. And we also did some things in part related to it, but in part related to a TV show called Battlefield Detectives on another project, but I used the information, where we set up a live fire of a cannon. And we fired the cannon remotely. The Army wouldn't let us go out there and do this. It was Yuma Proving Grounds in Arizona. This is high-speed videography going on here, but it's a nice shot of how a cannon actually goes off. All that flame and all that smoke, so you don't see anything. That's the cannonball. And that's all the debris from the cartridge and the what they call a sabot, or the wooden part that holds the cannonball onto the cartridge, which is made of linen. It's being fired, and there it is going out. And, you know, there's the barrel, so look how high that is. Well, that's a part of the trajectory of a cannonball. That's what they do. And then we're able to trace it with Weibolt radar and do drag coefficients. Anybody that's into ballistics might understand that, but not relevant. Anyway, we could trace that. This is how fast it's going in meters per second, and this is how long it takes to get to where it's going. So from the time it left the muzzle till the time it first hits the ground is about 4 seconds. And then it bounced. and for a couple of seconds or a second and a half, and then it bounced and rolled out for a couple of seconds, and it bounced and rolled out. It's called grazing. Three grazes. And then they're actually, because they knew how far out this was, because you can calculate distance and time, or a distance from the time and the velocity, they were actually go out and pick up that cannonball, and we were able to study it. It was non-explosive. It was a modern reproduction, a solid shot. But that gives us an idea of how those cannons really did work. And they did, the solid shot was meant to hit the ground and bounce up and hit you in the chest. And then go through that and go through the next line of guys after it bounced again, and then hit you in the knees. So, why did people lose legs? We also looked at fracture mechanics of the explosive cannonballs as models. Engineering models, and it's just classic fracture mechanics. And surprise, these break at the weakest point. And then they randomly fracture around the sphere. These are all spherical cannonballs that we're looking at. And these had hollow centers, most of them, that had bursting charges in them or shrapnel. And so we're looking at that process of how these break up. And that, how many pieces it break up in. Well, historically, he said 10 to 12. Well, they break up a few more than that, but basically that's what we were discovering. So we were validating some of the historic record, but that helps us understand how this stuff works in a modern sense. We also did scanning electron microscopy. That became actually the most important. The stuff over here, pretty picture of the crystalline structure of a thin section of a cannonball. But it told us that this stuff cooled in a very slow, normal manner. We saw this both on the southern side and the northern side from the fragments of cannonball that we had from Wilson's Creek. This stuff is all probably made before the war started. It was all probably in federal arsenals. It's just stuff they had. It had been made to standard. It was so both sides were using the same ammunition. It was U.S. ammunition for the most part. It's just stuff that was made, and they had time to do it properly. The one over here is actually from Pea Ridge, Arkansas, in March of 62. And this one tells a different story. It's a different crystalline structure, and it's a Confederate, at that point, cannonball thin slice. And we're seeing it cooled very rapidly. So this suggests this was actually made over the winter time. With that, we can now go back and talk a little bit about logistics, because we all know that the Southerners never had any good stuff. They fought courageously with bad material, cast-off weapons, particularly here in the Trans-Mississippi West. Well, this tells us that we had pretty good logistics. They were getting fresh supplies of cannonballs that had been made over the wintertime. We looked at the firearms at Wilson's Creek and Pea Ridge and these other sites, based on how you do firearms identification, like a crime scene lab would do, tells what kind of gun they were fired in and all this sort of thing. Both sides had pretty much current weapons. Now, some of them were a little older. Both sides had older smooth bores that came out of the arsenals because they didn't have enough time. The armories didn't have time to make everything that was needed by late 1861, early 1862. But some of the myth of the Southerners being armed with shotguns and squirrel guns is just that. It's a myth. These guys had the latest available muskets for the most part. Some older models, and some, of course, didn't have it particularly. But we're learning a lot more about this logistical stuff and the fact that things are not quite what the record says. And we're using things like viewshed analysis or terrain analysis or weapons fan analysis, the military call it. So here we are with the distribution of all the artifacts we found in the work we did at Wilson's Creek. The green are mostly rifle and pistol bullets. The blues and reds, indicate a variety of artillery rounds that are over here. But here we're looking specifically at canister, which are the dark-colored ones, and we're going to concentrate right down here. And that's some of that bar shot that I showed you a minute ago. And that bar shot, because we know it can't be fired at ranges more than about 400 yards, it wasn't really good for the gun barrel anyway. We could begin to use that to do a reverse analysis along with other kinds of weaponry material, related artillery, and we're able to back engineer likely locations of where those gun positions were. So we have here shown in the blue, what this does is say artillery at that time had to be fired by being able to see your target. So we know that the stuff that Backhoff's battery, Union battery, was firing at the Southerners, he had to be able to see this area. That's where we found the stuff, suggesting his gun positions had to be on the edge of this. Well, Backhoff was over here. We know from the historical record he came in, so we can relocate in general where he was. You have Reed's Pulaski battery, and this is the area he could see, and we know the federal artillery was firing into this area, and then the green indicating Bledsoe. Bledsoe, we do know that he was firing at the Federals down here, so he had to have his battery someplace. Well, we knew Gabor was over here. Bledsoe was over here, according to the accounts. So we were able to narrow Bledsoe's gun battery location down, and with that information, we were able to pinpoint, based on the road systems we knew it existed, that Bledsoe's battery is probably located right in there. And that was up higher than the Park Service thought it should be. But we found the road system. We found an artillery button up there. So I think we can locate that within reasonable odds. Now, the other kinds of things we do are geophysics, which is, you've heard of it, ground-penetrating radar, magnetics, things like that, allow us to look at near-surface archaeological deposits. And they don't find stuff for us. They find what we call anomalies or features that would have to be dug up and interpreted. Island Mound is where we tried this. And traditionally, this is the site where, of course, the first Kansas colored fought with Missouri guerrillas in November of 61 or 62. This is the first action by an African-American unit in combat in the United States. It predates the stuff a little further east, like the 54th Massachusetts, although they weren't federalized, so they don't get the credit for it. But they had gone on patrol. In fact, there were a couple of African-American officers, which when they were federalized had to be dismissed because they couldn't have African-American officers a little later. But they camped somewhere in here in the Toothman Farm site. And our goal when this came into the Missouri State Parks system was to try to locate the Toothman Farm site and the site of what was called Fort Africa, which was nothing more than the Toothman Farmstead, a house that was adapted to use by the 1st Kansas Colored Headquarters. This is one of the depictions of the fighting at Island Mound. Now, we didn't deal with the area where the actual fighting occurred, but only where the farmstead house thought to be. And this is Stephen DeVore from the National Park Service, is using a magnetometer to walk back and forth over the ground and collecting magnetic data. He used a couple of other instruments as well. But then you come up with a map that looks like this, which is confusing at best in some ways, but traces of a trail, which may be just modern, but we don't know for sure. Rock quarry, a big depression out here. We could see that on the ground. But right in here, these little rectangular structures are probably the Toothman farmhouse and an associated building. May have been a double pin building of some sort. So we have a location, and that's been, I haven't seen the reports or anything, archaeologically tested not too long ago. We're also looking to see if we could find evidence of mass grave for the 18 or so soldiers, African-American soldiers who were killed there. Didn't find anything definitively, but it doesn't mean that it isn't there or wasn't there. There's lots of issues about finding graves is much more difficult than CSI would like you to see. Marg Hellenberger just, it's not the way it works. I'm going to move on to Centralia now and talk about a couple of things there and pulling some things together, I hope. Now, we've got Jesse and Frank James there and Buddy Bill Anderson and the Price's raids going on through Missouri at this particular time in 1864. Todd and Anderson are out there trying to draw the Federals away from Price so that Price can do his thing and either capture St. Louis, didn't work, Jefferson City, didn't work. But they do have a pretty good fight at Pilot Knob. In the meantime, Anderson's men ride into Centralia from their camp on the outskirts of town. Camp is down in here. This is Centralia. This is kind of the core area of Centralia in 1864. And I'm sure you're all aware that they pull some Federals off the train that comes into town, about 20 of them, and execute them on the spot because they're all unarmed, they're all on furlough. Most of them from a Missouri Engineer Group and a unit. And they save one of them back, a Sergeant Goodman, because they want to exchange him for a sergeant that's been captured. At least that's one story. And so we have Goodman's account of what happened out there. The massacre is the killing of these people in town, pulled off the train. That's the massacre. Then there's the fight outside of town. So shortly after, Todd and his men not only kill the Federals, but loot the town, drink as much whiskey as they possibly could, shoot up the place, and of course it's a southern sympathizing town. They leave and head back to their camp down here on the creek. And in the meantime, Major Johnson with the 39th Missouri Volunteer Infantry, who are mounted on horses and mules, and by the way, they've only been in uniform a month or so. Johnson's had experience, but this is a new unit, just recruited, and his battalion is trying to find out where the guerrillas are operating and stop them, of course. But he rides into town, and he's outraged by the massacre of the soldiers that have they find on the street. And those folks were buried in a mass grave in the edge of town and later removed to the National Cemetery. But then they're told by the townspeople that where the guerrillas are, and they leave some men in town, then they head off cross country down through this way in order to attack this group. And about 150 men, give or take, Major Johnson and a couple officers, and about 150 men. This is the Confederate memorial to the partisans or guerrillas that were there that's on this alleged site, which proved to be the case as the location. Johnson arrives with these men. He deploys, he dismounts. Every fourth man holds a horse or mules for the other three men he's with. They deploy into line. They have some skirmishers out. They march forward. They see about 80 of the men, which has been described, who had come into town under Anderson. And they're deployed right here in the creek bottom or along the edge of the... And it probably doesn't look much different than that. It was an open field. And they stop. They see the guys apparently getting ready to mount up, the guerrillas and the Union troops fire with their infield rifles, British infield rifles. And they fire at them, and before they can reload, those guys mount up and charge. And then there's about another 300 or so hidden in the brush, and they all mount up and charge out with pistols blazing and destroy the command, the Union command. Now, I would argue that that's not a massacre. That's a battle because everybody going into it knew they were going to be in a fight. It just happened to be the Union lost all but six or so of the men. The guerrillas chased few survivors, probably the horse holders, back to Centralia, catch a number of men there, kill a few more there, and chase them almost all the way back to Sturgeon. So it's an amazing event. We did quite a bit of work there. Not a lot of return. Of course, we did find this, which was wonderful, until we picked it up and looked at it. It says, made in Italy. It's a reproduction pistol. And it was lost by a reenactor when they had a reenacting event on the site. And they even know, we even know who lost it. But the interesting thing is, this is actually one reason why today National Park Service and certainly many state agencies do not allow reenacting on site, because it can compromise the archaeological record and destroy evidence, frankly. But be that as it may, we found this stuff, mainly pistol balls and equipment pieces laying around, which helped us understand something of the fighting. It didn't give us a whole lot of new information. We knew they had brushed out the Confederates or guerrillas and shot up the Union boys, and it was a bad situation. And that's the kind of the artifact distribution. It was consistent with the story. There had been some terracing. There had been some other things that have compromised the site a little bit. But we're still able to find it. That was the important thing. And we were able to locate it and say this was the Centralia site, the battle site. The location in town is actually pretty well known because we got the maps of where things were. But what we did was try to confirm and validate this in a couple of ways. And what I'll come to is that this is how we do this kind of analysis with this computer-aided stuff. One thing was a question, the fight on Young's Creek here, when Major Johnson came in, could he see all these Confederates? Okay, they're hidden in the brush, for one thing, so no, he couldn't. But could he see them? So we used this terrain analysis approach thing. He had a good field of view. He had a good field of fire. This would, if he stopped up in here, this would be his field of fire for his musket. So he could have covered himself pretty well. But he was overwhelmed and surprised, outnumbered about 2.5 to 1. Although all the guerrillas supposedly only had pistols and unerringly shot all these men in the head, by the way. You buy that? I'll come to that. Back to that. So he would not have seen them in the brush. We can't, with the analysis we do, we can't see brush and trees. We just use what the landform is. So Johnson had a good field of fire. So this is an honest fight that just went the wrong way. Now, there are statements from the people in town that some of them stood on top of a hotel building and were able to see the fight. Well, that's 4 miles away. Could they? Yes. It's right there. If you take that location, which was the hotel, and it was a three-story hotel, we calculated the height, give or take a few feet, and were able to say the people standing there could have seen that far if they had good eyes or assistance with optical instruments. So yes, they could have seen something going on. Probably what they saw, horses running around, perhaps gun smoke in the air. But yes, they could have. So that validates that account, which gives more credibility to those people and their oral history. So that was a valuable part of it. But, and of course, there were hundreds. We found over 100 newspaper articles on the Centralia massacre and battle. And many of them contemporary. And of course, they were exaggerated in early in 1864-65. By 1877 and up to 1937, and I think the last one we had, it was from somebody who was actually around. I think it was an eyewitness from a young boy at the time. We had all this information about these, what the fight was all about and who was there and so on. So I just took a couple images just to show you that we had lots of information. And it was very confusing because we have Frank James's account. And we have a couple of other Confederate guerrilla accounts. And nobody agrees, even between the Confederate guerrillas about what happened. Then you get to the few surviving Union accounts and the locomotive conductor or locomotive engineer account and some passenger accounts about what, and nobody's telling the same story. So what was going on? And there's a story, and you'll see it right here. It says, in regard to unfurling a black flag, which is no quarter, this is pure imagination. And yet that story persists. This is an 1877 account by somebody who was there, he was actually in Centralia, not at Young's Creek. So there's these things come about, and what do you do about them? Well, newspaper accounts are great, but you have to take them with a grain of salt. We may have read in the paper that of erroneous accounts being perpetrated by reporters, intentionally or otherwise. We may have seen people who are just giving their opinion. By the time you get to 1877 or 1887 or 1937, how are people's memories? Well, I didn't remember what I did yesterday. So we did some stuff that nobody had done before. We went to the National Archives. And we found the pension records of some of the men on the Union side who had been there and were survivors. One of them was a guy named James Cumming. Or this is Frank Henry or Frank Barnes, his card. We also have James Cummings. Barnes was probably in Centralia, and he had 13 bullet wounds in his body. And he survived. Jim Cummins had a couple of gunshots, and he's listed in the record as John Cummings in a lot of the newspaper accounts and stuff. In fact, he is actually James, according to his pension records. He lived through it, and this is from his pension file, and this is a surgeon after many years afterward documenting his scars and the fact that bullets are still embedded in his body. Now, Mr. Barnes has lived quite an interesting life. He became a tobacconist in Omaha, Nebraska. Didn't like that, so he joined the Army again as a cavalryman and was out west and just missed the Powder River fight with the 5th Cavalry in the 1870s and came back and became an artilleryman and then retired from the Army, and he died and buried at Fort Smith. But Mr. Cummins didn't talk much about the war afterward, but did apply for a pension. And he gives his account in the record of what happened according to him. And he says, I was there with Johnson's command. We fired our round. We're unable to reload because we're up. The horsemen were on us in a moment, a few seconds. And we were shot down. And a group of us surrendered. And then we were shot down unmercifully. And most of the men were shot in the head. They were executed, according to Mr. Cummins. Now, is that true or not? No, I cannot believe Jesse James was that good a shot from horseback to shoot every guy he saw in the head. I just can't buy that. So there's Frank Barnes. Henry F. Frank Barnes is his tombstone at Fort Smith National Cemetery. So I'm going to ask a rhetorical question here. Was Centralia a massacre? Well, we think the part in town, the wanton and complete destruction of one group by another, the fight in town, the taking the men off the railroad cars, yes, that's a massacre. That fits. That's a 19th century definition, by the way, not modern. Was Centralia a war crime? Now, this is today's standards, and there are a series of things. Would the fight at Young's Creek with Johnson's command and Todd's men, Todd and Anderson, qualify as a war crime? Well, we're going to apply today's standards, Geneva Convention, crimes against peace, which are violations of treaties or assurance, a war crime, violation of a custom or law of war, and crimes against humanity, murder and other inhumane acts. Well, I don't think crimes against humanity work because these men went into a fight knowing that they were in a battle in a desperate situation and there was no quarter given to guerrillas. Under General Order 100, which had been issued in 1863 by Abraham Lincoln and, by the way, is the foundation of the Geneva Conventions, written by a man named Franz Lieber, who was a German and a lawyer from Columbia Law School, and he developed these in 1862. Not these terms, but he created his General Orders 100. which the Union ascribed to. And it says you can't kill prisoners of war. You have to treat civilians decently. You can't loot them and so on and so forth. But it also says if you have partisans who are not wearing a distinctive insignia to suggest they are an opposing force, you may execute them summarily in the field. No quarter is given, no quarter is expected. Not a crime against humanity, even under the 1864 thing. Crimes against peace, violation of treaties or assurances. Well, if General Orders 100 had also been issued on the Confederate side, yes, but it was not. And the Confederacy acknowledged it but did not sign it. So it doesn't work for them. So it's not a crime against peace. And that's generally against civilian populations anyway. Other things the guerrillas may have done may have qualified as that. A war crime, violation of the law or custom of war. I think this one can be applied. Well, you have to be very careful with it because, again, it's modern terminology. But I do buy that Anderson's men did violate law or custom of war by shooting prisoners. You're not, in any case, you never shoot prisoners of war. And they did. These men surrendered on the ground. And so I would say, yes, that one fit that. Now, that's just it's a rhetorical question. You can argue that, and I won't argue with you later. I'll answer a lot of questions, but I won't argue about that. It's just my opinion. And since it's my idea, I get to win. I am going to conclude here with a couple things. And I've been talking about battlefields and conflict. We're using history, memory, and the archaeological record, the physical evidence, if you will, and learning and teaching about the past. It's all fun. It's really interesting. I hope you found it interesting. Is there relevance today? Well, you're here. It's a sesquicentennial. So 150th anniversary of many of these events are coming up, if not a past. So there is some interest. But there's another real world scenario here. And that's that staff rise and leadership training are used in the U.S. military today and worldwide. Use battlefields and historic sites to teach about leadership and organization and tactics using past examples. And in fact, I've helped write two staff manuals using archaeological evidence to show events occurred precisely on this location, which then these people can go back and rework and rethink and say, this is what happened in the past. Now, how would we do it today? So they're on the site. And in fact, having that location precisely located, instead of just over here, but saying the evidence suggests that this event occurred at this location, you know, within this room, literally, it makes a difference in the way people see the ground. They use that viewshed analysis, this weapons fan sort of approach to things, so they can see things better, they can understand it, and also put it in modern perspective. So there's a real value there. And there's another one that I'm going to come to as why I'm interested in this stuff. And that's justice. Not for the past. That's historical information. But I have literally taken this data, these models that I talked about, and applied them in real-world situations. That's me testifying at Saddam Hussein's trial using this battlefield modeling stuff and showing that the part that I was testifying about, a particular incident in Kurdistan in 1987, was in fact not a combat action, but an execution of 33 men and boys. And I used literally the process I've kind of talked about here to do that. So you can bring this to the real world. And it is something that I think is kind of lost sometimes. Archaeology is always looked at as esoteric old stuff, when in fact it has very real world implications today. And that's what I have.
We have time for several questions, so pepper away.
I'll start with the gentleman here.
Anderson never had a field commission from the Confederacy.
That's what I understand as well. Well, I tend to agree with you, but I suspect there are other people in this audience might argue a little bit. But I agree with you in principle. But he still was recognized by the government, Confederate government, as a partisan fighter. He was recognized. They just wasn't given a commission. That's true. Right back here. Yeah, and that's absolutely true, as I understand it as well, and it may have fueled his anger toward the Union. There's no question about that either. I'll go back to this gentleman back here and then come over.
Did you find at the Centralia massacre, shootout or whatever, any proper checks, Frenchmen fire cartridge bullets?
We did not. We found a variety of, it was all 44 caliber and 36 caliber, Colt and Remington. I did not see anything that looked like the Belgian or French pinfires, no. I'm not saying they weren't there, we just didn't find it. No, the pinfire revolver was common and actually was fairly popular, and I have seen them. I found some at Wilson's Creek, but not there, not at Centralia. Although, you know, they could have been there. We just didn't happen to find them. They may not have unloaded those there. We didn't find any bullets. Come over here. Yes, ma'am. That's a really tough question to ask a professional archaeologist. My answer would be it is always better to leave it in the ground, even for a professional, because it reaches a stasis. It's actually preserved. Now, some soils don't preserve as well as others. But as a professional archaeologist, I would say, yes, you should leave it alone and let the professionals do it. We can't get to everything. By the way, metal detecting and on Civil War sites and others is a legitimate hobby when you have the legal right to do so, which is private land, and you can go on the private land with landowner's permission. I have no truck with anybody that trespasses and does this stuff illegally. It's a legitimate hobby. I would just encourage people to think about the kind of information we're getting from this data set and record their information a little better if you're a hobbyist. Record your information where it's coming from. There are people like me that will actually talk to you. I'm going to come over here. Yes, ma'am.
What do you do about non-conflict things that you find? I mean, are you interested in that? Do you do anything with that? And how do you date it?
Well, we do find lots of stuff, material culture that is unrelated to the fights. It might be homesteads, farmsteads, activities that occurred before or after, prehistorically and historically. We record that information. I focused on what our interests are when we go out and look for it. But, people farm these areas for over a century, almost two centuries now. And we will, we do record the information, yes. So we don't ignore it. Sometimes we don't take it out of the ground. Sometimes we leave that when we find it. We just rebury it because it's the best thing to keep it preserved. And this gentleman back here again, and I'll come over here. Yeah.
The Butler fight, the Isle of Man.
Mm-hmm.
I was noticing on your photo, it looked like the grass was growing in certain straight lines.
Those were actually strings that were on the ground to guide the machines that were doing the recording.
I was wondering if that was the foundation that you found.
What you were seeing were the strings that we'd laid out to use the grid for the. Yeah. But the map that showed where we think the buildings were, is a magnetic map, and it doesn't show any vegetation. It's and there are actually residual artifacts, what we call artifacts, lines in those things where they piece all the computer files together. So you're seeing something that's. I think that's what you're probably talking about. Yeah, yeah. And then.
Given that history is written by the winners, have any of your investigations changed the account of how the battle supposedly was conducted?
Well, in most cases, the historical record does say who won, who lost, and that we don't change that very often. We can get to details that are not recorded, and that may, in a number of cases, were. The precision with the archaeological information. I think let me use an analogy. That may be the easiest way to explain this. You know, in crime scene work, the investigators go out and interview the alleged perpetrators, the witnesses, the victims, and so forth, if they're still alive, and then you have the forensic scientists go out, and the worst possible testimony you have is a witness. Ask any lawyer. But the forensic science is the hard data, and that's what archaeologists do, is an analogy there. But it's that you can't say they're wrong, we're right, or vice versa. It's putting it all together. It's a holistic look at things. Just like a crime scene investigation, you parse all the information together, and you build a more complete picture, in our case, of the past, a more accurate and complete picture. We can get to details that are not recorded off in the historic record, about the movements of people across the landscape and actual, you know, even precision in some of the fighting, types of weapons used that may or may not be relevant to the bigger picture, but sometimes might be, as to understanding that, oh, well, these had the latest firearms with the best accuracy and the longest range. Well, we didn't know that. We knew they were able to outfight them for some reason. So, or the ambush. The ambush at Centralia becomes much more clear about why they were so successful. The historic record was pretty clear about parts of it, but not all of it. So it's putting it all together. It's not about one piece, the archaeology being right or more precise or more accurate. It's all of it coming together to tell a more complete story of the past. And actually, I think having be able to see things that were actually there is kind of neat. Other, I wouldn't be in this business for almost 50 years. I'll go with the young lady right there.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. When you were commenting upon reenactors, the Battle of Boonville was reenacted last spring.
Yes, I was there.
All right, did it occur? I wasn't able to.
They were a little further to the north than the actual fighting occurred on Dr. Avery's property. So, no, they had thought that through. They actually got away from that. And it was a lot of fun, actually. yes, ma'am, here.
The solicitations that you get through the mail for funding for preservation of battlefields, are those legitimate?
Depends on which organizations they are.
Well,
there's the American Battlefield... National Historic Trust. There's a number of friends of different battlefields that are all those tend to be legitimate, I think. I can't think of one offhand that I've ever seen that is not trying to actually preserve some battlefield. You might have Boonville or Centralia or Friends of Centralia, I know, are absolutely a legitimate group in this. The group, the foundation I've been working with as a volunteer, I might add, America's or Missouri Civil War Heritage. They don't do a lot of soliciting. They try to find grant money from other sources. So there's places, but there are lots of them out there. They're usually friends groups of a site. So yeah, it's worth checking them out. You know, you want to be sure you're given if you're going to donate money.
Terrific maps.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, there's some great folks out there doing some great stuff. But if you're not sure, double check. Yeah, no, it's worth it. Yeah. Come back here, this gentleman, and then over there, okay?
Is there a difference in caliber between Confederate and federal rifle balls?
The easy answer is no. They mostly use 58 caliber muskets, rifled muskets. But yes, you know, it depends on what caliber you're using and all that. But they tended to use pretty much the same kind of ammunition. Now, the type of rifling in some of the guns will tell you what they were, and that can sort things out. The Confederacy as a whole did capture a lot of federal weapons and used them. So, you know, there's lots of, you know, I could give you a really long answer, and if you want to buy me a beer, I'll talk to you.
A couple more questions?
Yeah, a couple more. I'll get to tell me here.
This is more of an announcement than anything else. I really appreciate your talk. I'm Dan Smith with Vinette out of Westport Fund. And so you're right on target of what we're interested in. But I wanted to take this opportunity because of the discussion here that we will be having invite you to the Civil War Roundtable summer session on Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock at the Plaza Library, where we'll be talking about these very topics of the Civil War in Jackson County, Part 2, 63 and 64, up until the actual Battle of Westport. So anyway, thanks so much for your talk.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
And any one last question, yeah. I'll go up here. You've had a couple, sorry.
was there any consistency as far as the depth that you're finding Civil War material?
It is reasonably consistent. It depends on how much plowing has occurred in the field and all that, but usually it's anywhere from 4 to 6 inches. Occasionally it's right on surface, but not very often, but 4 to 6. Metal detectors do have a limitation in depth, of course, and it depends on the models you're using and the type and all that. So, but most of the stuff is not, and it really does depend on how much plowing has turned, deep plowing has turned things over. And most of these sites have been plowed at one time. Not all.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out.
Thank you.